This show is brought to you by Safety FM.
What's up, peeps? Welcome back to Rebranding Safety. It's that time again. It's time for a new quarterly co-host. Let's jump into the intro and I shall tell you some more about what we're talking all about this quarter. Let's go.
The problem in safety isn't deviation, it's complexity.
Health and safety has gone mad.
Health and safety is trying to unpick having gone mad in the past.
There's no one solution or one problem. The problem is that we are looking for one solution.
Does the structure of the team allow them to flourish?
Feel safe enough to be uncomfortable.
The environment defines our behaviors.
People aren't the problem, they're the solution.
Rebranding Safety. Crushing a stereotype. Brought to you by Risk Blue.
What's up, peeps? Welcome back to Rebranding Safety. Rebranding Safety is a YouTube channel and podcast doing exactly what it says on the tin. So if you're new here, hit that subscribe button and the bell and all of those magical algorithm me thingamajiggies. My name is James McPherson from the company Risk Fluent Limited. We are your host today, and our guest, our new quarterly co-host, is the amazing Tom Geraghty, who's a psychological safety expert. So we are going to do three episodes, quarterly co-host styley. One episode end of the month of the quarter. There we go. And we're going to be getting into psychological safety. It's a massive part of what we do, but it still feels quite new. And when I kind of come across Tom, which was through a local networking, I was like, we need to talk to you, we need to get you on, we need to let people know kind of really where psychological safety came from, maybe dispel some myths, maybe make some corrections, maybe let people know about disasters and so on. So here is episode one. I'm not going to introduce Tom because he does a much better job of introducing himself. So let's jump into the podcast. Tom, welcome to the podcast, mate.
Thanks so much for having me.
Hey, no worries, mate. Thank you very much for coming on. Do you want to give a little introduction to yourself first and then we'll get into it?
Yeah, thanks. We'll do. So my name's Tom Geraghty. I'm the founder, the creator of a website called psychsafety.com. I've got like a couple of decades experience in mostly in tech leadership and managing and leading tech teams and stuff like that. More recently focused on sort of organizational transformation and organizational dynamics. But my mastermind subject, if you like, I guess is psychological safety and safety cultures, and that's the thing I'm really, really passionate about. And yeah, that's what I do for a living now.
Yeah, so I connected to you through Gemma, who I know does some work with yourselves. Mm-hmm. And she's mentioned a couple of times in like this networking group that we both go to, that it's hard for her to really like nail down specific customers. She said, I've got customers that do this. And I've got customers that work in psychological safety. And I can see the room just being like, what is that? And obviously they're like, I know exactly what it is, I think.
Yeah.
But we're going to do kind of a quarterly co-host. So we're going to go through three episodes. And today, do you want to just give us a summary of kind of what you wanted to kick us off with? And today, like the idea of what we're going to talk about today.
Yeah. So that's brilliant. Yeah. And I'm really looking forward to all of these. I think this can be super fun. I think it's really important to like lay down essentially what we're talking about when we talk about psychological safety. It's a term, it's a phrase that more and more people are hearing about. It's you're hearing it kicking about the workplace, whether you're in safety, you know, health and safety or technology or aviation or whatever. We're starting to hear this phrase more and more often, and which is great, but it also means that there's a lot more tendency for it to be interpreted a bit maybe not the way it was originally intended, not the way the sort of official definition is. So if we sort of lay that out, then I think that'd be really valuable. So the term psychological safety itself, I think, was, as far as I'm aware of anyway, first coined in the 1960s by two guys called Edgar Schein and Warren Bennis. They were talking about organizational change. And then not a lot happened really for a while. And then in the 90s, some people started to pick it up. A guy called Kahn, William Kahn, I think, started looking at it. I think he was studying summer camp counselors, and then Amy Edmondson, who is now the sort of the name that most people know of when you think of psychological safety. She was studying clinical teams at Harvard. She's still at Harvard. She's at Harvard Business School. So she was studying clinical teams. And I'll keep this really short, but maybe we can dive into this in a minute. But what she was looking at as clinical teams, and what she found was that high-performing clinical teams in this context were admitting more mistakes, admitting their mistakes, whereas low-performing clinical teams were hiding theirs. And of course, this all starts to make sense, because this ability to admit and talk about and address mistakes and continuously improve was how those teams got to high performing, and the low performing teams kind of got stuck in this cycle of keep making the same mistakes over and over again. And so through Amy's research, she coined a definition of psychological safety, that it is the belief that one will not be punished or humiliated for speaking up with ideas, questions, concerns, or mistakes, and that the team is safe for interpersonal risk taking. And in fact, that's a really powerful definition, because it raises these four things: these ideas, questions, concerns, or mistakes. And in fact, if we only remember those four things, then we're pretty good. Yeah, that's psychological safety in a nutshell.
I'm glad that we kind of wanted. I think when we both kind of first got into talking about this, and I knew guys coming on the podcast, and we were like, I was quite clear in that I wanted to know if I've interpreted it correctly, right, as to what it was originally intended, because there was part of me that was like, kind of what you alluded to, in a much nicer way than I might, in that I see a lot of stuff out on LinkedIn and I'm like, I'm no psychological safety kind of expert, but even though I think that's complete bullshit, what you've just said. And yeah, I'm like, I think a lot of people are really kind of missed it. And I think there's kind of like a trade-off, isn't there? When things become popularized, it's really good that everybody's talking about it, but it also, the trade-off is that it becomes a bit diluted. And I can kind of see why, because I think I find it quite funny in that, particularly in safety, one of the things that gets demonized quite a lot in more mature safety is like oversimplification. Mm-hmm. So, and I think psychological safety has suffered from that a little bit. But ultimately, if you look into like nudge theory, simplification is a nudge. So yeah, it's like, if you want to nudge people to get something, you've got to simplify it, but then don't simplify it too much, because then you dilute it. And I, as a practitioner, who basically my job is to read all of this stuff, keep an eye on all of this stuff that's happening and how we can improve, and then take that to my customers who are doers. You know, they're people that run businesses and they're doing the do. I have to simplify it, and I find it's like a real hard thing to balance. Is that oversimplification, yeah, and simplification and good simplification, if that makes sense.
Yeah, yeah, completely. And in fact, there's a term for what you just described, which is semantic diffusion, which is a term coined maybe by someone else, but from my knowledge, it's coined by Martin Fowler, who was talking about the term DevOps and technology. And some of the most, and I think this is why psychological safety has really sort of touched the sort of industry and like made such a connection, because it is fundamentally, it feels rather simple. And we almost instinctively, we get what it feels like to be like, to be on a team and feel psychologically safe. We don't need all the definitions and research. We instinctively get it to a degree. There is a danger that we oversimplify it, and it begins to turn into this sort of wellness kind of like faddy kind of like mental, like men, it's often connected to mental health. It's often connected, yep, to wellness. And yes, it is related to those things. But I think it's kind of doing it a disservice to say, oh, it's like just a thing to do with mental health, or it's just a thing to do with wellness at work. No, it's like, it's the foundation of all performance and innovation and avoidance of error or mitigating error and improving and developing from error and everything else. Like, it's, Deming knew this back decades ago. Like, yeah, it is the foundation. He said, drive out fear so that everyone may work effectively for the company. He knew that the presence of psychological safety, he didn't use the term, but he knew that the presence of fear would calcify and chill an organization to a point at which they could no longer do anything. And yeah, that's my experience as well.
I find this, I'm going to go a little bit down a rabbit hole, because I find this is a really challenging balance I find for me, myself, but also our customers, other professionals, practitioners that we talk to. This kind of, and you touched on it, what you said about deming and fear and kind of blame and stuff like within an organization and having psychological safety, and this whole like, this balance between the two, in the what we might call blame, is accountability. So people being accountable for their errors and employers being able to kind of hold someone to account. And you don't, if you're running a business, you don't want to be like, oh, it's just willy-nilly, do whatever you want. Yeah. You've got to set a standard, right? So as a company, you're trying to deliver a consistent quality product. You're trying to make sure that people do stuff, you know, in a certain way. And that, I don't think there's anything wrong with that. I think that's good business. I mean, I stay in a Premier Inn because I know it's exactly the same every time I go there. So if you're at Premier Inn, you want your employees to be accountable for delivering that standard. But then there's this whole notion, I think, where we've gone, particularly the practitioners have gone, like we're seeing stuff now, like no blame and stuff, because they've gone and gone, oh, if we blame people, it introduces a fear of being blamed and then reduces their likelihood to speak up, therefore reducing psychological safety. And this whole balance of how to, what it looks like in reality, is really hard, I find.
Yeah, it is really hard. It is really hard. And actually, if we get into the sort of meat of it, like if we actually begin to work with psychological safety and what it really means, it doesn't mean the absence of accountability or the absence of standards. In fact, it means, in practice, really, it means the ability to hold ourselves and our other team members to even higher and higher standards, without fear that we're going to break up the team or sort of be accused of being a nitpicker or something like that. Yeah. The presence of psychological safety on a team means that we can say, someone produces a report or something, then if we feel psychologically safe, we feel psychologically safe to point out improvements, mistakes, or challenge even, you know, the message of the report or something, for example. We can continuously improve each other and ourselves because we feel psychologically safe to do so. It doesn't mean the absence of, it doesn't, like I said, it doesn't mean just being willy-nilly and just going, oh, yeah, well, that went wrong, but no one's to blame, so, yeah.
I find that that's a common struggle for, I think, even for us with our customers, like it's still a struggle trying to balance this world of holding people to account, which I know some people don't like, and then also this promoting psychological safety, but then also it not just being like, you know, a complete free world to just do what you want, which you can't do. And I think people struggle with the notion. I think that's the first thing where this falls down. And ironically, I think we did exactly the same thing as to what we're critical about, is that we oversimplified even the notion of blame. We've oversimplified that to go, oh, let's do it. We're a no blame company. And I'm like, that's just as stupid as like half of the stuff that you badmouth, like Zero Harm, for example.
Yeah. Well, exactly. I think it's important to recognize that we cannot be blameless. Like, we, not only does blameless lead, just like a strive to completely blameless lead to quite strange places or difficult places where maybe we feel like we can't investigate the causes of problems, lest we inadvertently find that someone was at fault, whatever that fault was. But also we're fundamentally kind of primitive humans, and we're coded to find blame and point blame and find smoking guns and stuff like that. So a better approach really is to be consciously blame aware and like recognize when we are leaning towards blaming something or someone, and try and recognize and go, oh, we're leaning towards blaming this person for doing this thing. And naturally, you know, human error Like, human error shouldn't be the end of investigations. It should be the start of investigations. Yeah. This is kind of the whole safety two paradigm and everything. You could argue there's no such thing as human error. That's a debate worth having, probably. But
another three episodes in it.
Like, being blame aware is much more powerful than trying to be blameless, I think.
I find it fascinating, and I've kind of done it myself here, in that the reason why I find this conversation comes up every time we start talking about becoming more mature, increasing performance within teams, and therefore increasing psychological safety and so on. The conversation normally always, the mindset, I don't know whether it's just maybe British culture or what, but always ends up going to after the fact of something's gone wrong. Whereas I find psychological safety for me is like, why are we not talking about the bit before something goes wrong, which is where psychological safety for me comes into its own, and somebody saying, we got a problem here, before it becomes a problem, if that makes sense.
Completely, completely. I often talk about how psychological safety is the precursor. It's the foundation. It's the necessary environment in which safety can occur. Because safety is kind of just like psychological safety. Safety is a weird thing to measure, right? Because it's the absence of things going wrong. It's the absence of something. So, and psychological safety is the absence of the fear of being punished or humiliated. So, it's kind of hard to measure the absence of something, right? So, but psychological safety itself, and if this, it's almost a priori true that if we want there to be fewer mistakes, fewer risks, fewer dangers, then we need to create an environment in which people can point out those mistakes, even if they're their own, and this is really important, even if they're their own, or even if they might suffer some sort of interpersonal risk as a result of pointing it out, or, you know, the extreme end of that is whistleblowing, but we sort of hear about that every now and then. In the NHS and other organizations, but actually at the far more common end of that is just the pointing out of that that railing's a bit broken, or some job that someone did 6 months ago actually needs redoing, but that person was, you know, your mate, and so do you point it out or do you not point it out? Because it kind of could be done better, it could be improved, and that would make the world safety, make the world of work safer. But at the same time, you kind of pointed out that Bob, your mate, kind of messed up that job a little bit.
It's like a socially wicked problem in a way, isn't it? It's a really hard thing for us to deal with. I think I went down a couple of rabbit holes there, so I'm very aware. I want to kind of rein it in a bit more, because there's loads of names we've mentioned now already. So, I mean, just there's Shine, Edmondson, Deming. Like, could you kind of, I think a lot of us think that Amy Edmondson is, you know, the mother of psychological safety, when clearly she isn't, in what you said. So it would be kind of really helpful, I think, go back through that little timeline you went through earlier and maybe just kind of refreshing us, or maybe even introducing us into some of these key names.
Yeah, good shout. And I'm, timeline wise, I'm definitely going to get this wrong, but let's think about that. So yeah, like back in the, I think it was the 60s, Edgar Schein, Warren Bennis looking at organizational change, and they literally just mentioned psychological safety as a, I think it maybe was just once, maybe twice in the entire book. Following on from that, I think it's quite interesting that through the second half of the 20th century, people like Deming talked about driving out fear. Driving out fear so that everyone may work effectively for the company. He also talked about, I think the phrase is, where there is fear, you will find wrong figures. And he was making this point that where people are afraid of punishment for performance, or sort of not hitting metric targets, the figures will get massaged or maybe tweaked, or just, you know, even if it's subconsciously, they will end up in the wrong figures. So Deming knew this. When Taichi Ono was designing the Toyota production system in kind of conjunction with Deming, he was designing a system that was a socio-technical system. He wasn't just designing a factory production line like Taylor and Ford. He was designing a system that included people, and he was taking into account psychology of people. And there's some really interesting aspects to that. And so Taichi Ono would be very much a kind of proponent of psychological safety and safety cultures.
Just summarize socio-technical system, some of the listeners don't know what that is.
Good shout. So we have systems, we have technical systems, and that might be a factory production line, some sort of robot or machine or a software system. That's a technical system. We have social systems that are like communities, groups, schools, groups of people. And with socio-technical systems, and this is the recognition, the acknowledgement that most technical systems and most social systems actually interact together. A plane, for example, a plane or a submarine, I often use the example of a submarine, is a socio-technical system. It's a system made of people and technology working together, people creating and designing and manipulating the technology, but also the technology influencing and determining how people work and interact with it. So it's kind of a cycle. It's a feedback loop, people and technology influencing and working with each other. So we can't take them apart. But we can't pretend that one exists without the other. Mm. Yeah.
Yeah. I think for me, when I come across that, when I was first introduced into that kind of notion of a socio-technical system, it was quite enlightening for me personally, just to be like, oh yeah, of course there is both social and technical aspects to the majority of what we do. Even if you took a construction project, there are technical parts of that job that we're doing. The brick lays this way, and the systems or the process is this, and so on and so forth. The regs are this, but to do that job, you need people, and therefore there comes the social aspect of it.
Yeah, completely. And this is where you get into all the fields of ergonomics and human factors and everything that are really, really interesting and linked very much to safety cultures and psychological safety, because we have to recognize that people are flawed. We, the most incredible experts in the world carrying the same task that they're very, very good at over and over again will execute that task with variability and won't complete it to the same standard every single time.
Yeah.
And so when we create technical systems, we might believe in this perfect operator, this perfect person who just carries out the instructions perfectly every single time they do it. And of course that's completely flawed.
So we got to
active people. Yeah.
Deming, and I'm not going to try and pronounce his name because I've never been able to, but the Toyota guy.
Yeah, Taichi Ono.
Well done. I'm impressed that you can do that.
and then the list is probably almost infinite because it sort of spans out everywhere into the business world as well. But so you've got Amy Edmondson, who I think did an amazing job of her clinical research into teams was in 1999, and that was incredible work, and she wrote some great papers after that. But it wasn't until Google's Project Aristotle in 2013 that psychological safety began to be sort of noticed by the business world rather than just the academic world. And then Amy Edmondson wrote her book, The Fearless Organization, and that was either 2015 or 2016. I really should know that. But it was that was the catalyst. That was the, I think Amy and others had laid the foundations, set the fire, set the kindling, and it was the book, Amy Edmondson's book, that kind of lit that fire, and it took off from there. But in addition to that, I think we've got people like Eric Hollnagel in the safety world. We've got David Woods, resilience engineering, and the same sort of field. We've got Sydney Decker in human error. We've got people like David Marquet of the submarine. I don't know if you've read Turn the Ship Around, which is a great book about.
I haven't actually. It's on my to read list, which is ever growing.
Yeah, fantastic book, definitely worth reading. And whilst David doesn't, I don't think he ever uses the words psychological safety, but essentially what he did was create psychological safety on the submarine. through a bunch of practices that we can take out of submarine and use in our context. Then we've got people like Tim Clark, who wrote a book called The Four Stages of Psychological Safety, which the model itself receives quite a lot of criticism, but it is a useful model. I do think it's a useful model to help us understand that psychological safety has different manifestations, different dynamics. It's not just this kind of you feel safe or you don't kind of phenomenon. And then we've got people like Brené Brown and Kim Scott and people like that who are sort of talking more about the social, more about the psychology and social and sociological aspects of leadership and people, but definitely like addressing some really valuable stuff in the field. Yeah.
I think there's one thing to pull out of kind of what you've kind of gone through all of these people, and now it's like you've had like a bit of a line that's been like semi kind of flat line with like quite a nice little timeline of people like that have touched on this process of psychological safety, and then it's as it's received its boom, it's kind of split off into loads of different industries, all of which are utilizing the concept or variations of it in their own way. And I find like I don't know how aware you are of the safety profession that I am part of for my sins, and that we're addicted to tribalism, and I'll probably touch on this a bit too much in the podcast, but it does frustrate me a lot in that we seem to have very much gone like this one academic is the way to do absolutely everything, or this collection of two or three academics is the way to do everything. But I found it really interesting how you kind of said, oh, you've got like Decker, who kind of is in human error, for example. I know he touches on ethics quite a bit sometimes. You've got David Woods, like you're saying, resilience engineering, Honagle probably as well, safety two, resilience kind of engineering. But ultimately, like, I think my opinion is where practitioners should be thinking about this is kind of how you've summarized it. In that there are loads of different things that we can pull bits of out of. Like we look at how they utilize it in a submarine and we can go, do you know what? I'm going to try that in my wind farm, for example, and see how that works.
Yeah.
And then go, this thing here didn't work, but this did. And then this over here in the sports team example, that also worked really well. Like what do you think about that? That's how I try to approach it.
Yeah, completely, completely. And to be honest, that's what kind of keeps me going in this field, and it's what keeps me interested in and enthusiastic about it, because there are so many different examples and applications and contexts, you know, that we can take the Andon cord from the Toyota production system and take it and go to a technology team or a healthcare team and say, you know, and we can talk about the Andon cord and how Toyota use it, but then they can implement their own version, their own context. And that's what's so powerful. It's what I enjoy doing. We can cross-pollinate from different industries and different researchers and different fields. And what's really interesting? Yeah. So in fact, you talked about sort of the submarine. You talked about sports teams, and what works in one context doesn't necessarily work in another. Like in the military is incredibly hierarchical, ordered, and structured, right? And it's probably the most hierarchical organization or type of organization on the planet.
Yeah.
And but we talk about the military, the US Navy, the US Army, the UK armed forces address and talk about psychological safety in powerful terms in a context that is, this is really important for us. This is the foundation of all that we do. We need to build and foster psychological safety in our squadrons, in our units, in order to execute the very difficult things that we're required to do. And in their context, the hierarchy, the structure actually helps foster psychological safety. It helps people who have a job to do understand the parameters, the boundaries of their responsibility, their decision making, limits, and things like that. The principle of mission command in the military actually helps foster psychological safety by setting the parameters for decision making in the field.
Yeah.
In a different organization, hierarchy can be a real, it can be incredibly damaging for psychological safety. That just that those layers of management you have to go through to get anything done, and the bureaucracy involved, and the layers of authority, and the sort of the quite Tayloristic sort of being told what to do rather than being empowered, that can be quite damaging in those organizations. So my point really is that yes, we can take these different lessons from different contexts, but we have to recognize that not every context, not every application fits. You know, there is no one size fits all.
Yeah.
And I think where we get into the sort of problems with tribalism and saying, we must always, take a safety two approach. Well, yeah, like that's good, but sometimes you need a safety one approach as well. And sometimes you need this approach and sometimes you need that.
I find it fascinating that I can never give a serious response if anyone does say to me I will say it's less so now, but when I started rebranding safety four or 5 years ago, it was very much like, are you safety one or are you safety two? And I was like, are you joking? Like the book actually says, and.
It says and.
I'm not very good at English, but I'm pretty sure that means both. We've got like two more episodes, so we're going to go into this a hell of a lot more depth anyway, and we'll chew the fat on a lot of those points, because I think there's a couple of things that maybe not today, but in one of the other episodes that I'd like to understand or at least talk about a little bit more is kind of what you touched on about hierarchies and stuff, but also like people having clarity of understanding this is my role, this is my time, this is my expertise. You know, we talk about deference to expertise a lot in safety, but understanding is, am I the expert? Is this, are you deferring to me and so on? And then also motivation to speak up, because I go to a lot of businesses where actually they're really psychologically safe, like particularly male dominated environments, a lot of the shop floor feel real comfortable to speak up, and they will tell you, but they're just not motivated to. So that's something I think I'd like to touch on, but maybe we pause that for one and two, and I know we're yet to kind of really decide how we want to roll those two out, but again, for today, for the rest of the, it might, this episode, it might be worth really getting into some introducing psychological safety using some real life kind of disasters and catastrophes that have happened. Like, have you got a couple like key ones that really stick out in your mind that would be really good to kind of introduce the concept using that real life example?
I mean, and there are I kind of love talking about disasters because there are so many. There are just so many to choose from. In fact, I would argue, and I have argued in the past, that if you look at or find any disaster, anything that's gone wrong in the field of human endeavor, you can probably find somewhere a component cause of a lack of psychological safety somewhere in the process.
I use quite a lot, just to pick one out of the air. Yeah. There's two actually I use a lot, primarily because of the availability of content that I could use in workshops and stuff. The first example I use is the, which I can never remember the year, but the Everest team, where a number of them died and they wrote a book and they all fell out. Was it Robert something? I can't remember.
So you're thinking about that book, Into Thin Air?
Yeah. That's it. John Cracknor?
Krakauer,
yeah. And the really interesting story in there, that there was a pilot in that team that could read cloud formations but never spoke up. So we knew there was a storm coming but never spoke up. That's one example I use quite a lot. Feel free to add some more into that if you want to. And then I actually use the second one I use is, and it is dramatized, but from what I can find out, it's not too dramatized, is the TV, the HBO show Chernobyl, and the character of Dyatlov. I use a supercut of him in that show all the time, just someone who's clipped loads of bits, and not just him, like his bosses. And then if you understand the context of like the Soviet Union behind that and all of this stuff, like I just... That's a fascinating case study.
Yeah, and Chernobyl is a fascinating case study, really, because just like you say, the culture in the Soviet Union at the time, and probably still to this day, was maybe still is a very hierarchical, do as you're told, obey authority, don't challenge authority, don't speak up, just do as you're told, compliance culture. And that culture, so we've got that, so that's the socio part, and we've got the technical part, which is the plant itself, the Chernobyl plant, the RBMK 1000 reactor. And if you look at the Ukraine Nuclear Society reports of the study, they actually say that the RBMK 1000 reactor is an inherently unsafe design. It could only be operated in a culture where there, in an environment where there was no safety culture. So it could only be operated unsafely. So you've got those two aspects, the socio and the technical. You put them together, we're going to get a disaster. It's going to go wrong. And of course, that's what did happen, because they were trying to run a test to see if they could power the operations of the plant using spinning down turbines when they're no longer generating power, they're just momentum. And of course, so the operators felt this was an unsafe thing to do. They felt that this was not only an unsafe plant, but this was an unsafe test. But either people didn't speak up, they didn't feel safe to speak up because they'd be reprimanded, punished for doing so, or people did speak up, but that message doesn't get passed on. You know, we can look at other disasters where that's the case. But they conducted the test anyway, and of course we know what happened then: a steam explosion, nuclear explosion. I think 31 people died. And fundamentally, those people may not have died if people had felt psychologically safe enough to speak up. Now, that's not to say that, because there is no such thing as single root cause, but that's not to say that a lack of psychological safety was the root cause, but it was a component cause. Yeah. If there had been a culture of psychological safety in that plant, that disaster may well not have happened.
Yeah. And interesting, I don't know if I assume you've watched the show, the HBO show of Chernobyl. Have you watched it?
I actually have not, no.
It's actually, typically that stuff is like really dramatized. Yeah. It's actually not too bad. And then the supporting podcast that they did, where they had the film producer, the show producer on there, kind of goes through, essentially it's a whole podcast of him saying what is dramatized and what's not. Right. And he pretty much goes through and he's like, that's based on this record, that's based on that record. And nearly the whole show is like quite, and like correct, mm-hmm. which is rare as fuck, right? Yeah, like you get Deepwater Horizon and Mark Wahlberg like saving the day, with his massive muscles. But like this is actually quite, and the only character that's made up is there's a lady in there, there's a female scientist. She's a made up character. She actually represents a group of scientists that were trying to get the truth out, essentially, and try to say you've got a big problem here. So she represents a big group, and they only did that because they didn't want to have this massive group of cast of scientists. They just summarized it into one person. I'm no Chernobyl expert at all, but from what I can understand, it seems to be quite to record the show, which is rare.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's also, I find it really useful as a practitioner in, if I say to a business owner, for example, is running a medium-sized business, oh, go and read this paper by Deming. They're like, not a chance. But if I go and say, go and watch the HBO show, Chernobyl, and then we'll have a chat about it and we can pick stuff out. That's why I kind of use it quite a lot.
Yeah, completely. And it's exactly why I also use the example of the Challenger space shuttle disaster.
Yes, yeah.
Because that's a fantastic example of where it's a slightly different dynamic in terms of psychological safety. But there's a great Netflix documentary about it, really factual, really dives into what actually happened, what was actually going on. But again, addresses both the technical, which is the rubber O-rings on the solid rocket boosters on the side of the rocket, which I think they became brittle at low temperatures, and this was a sort of known problem. But the socio side of that, the social side of that was that the engineers, so the, at the bottom, so at the bottom, I don't really like using that term, but at the front, there were the engineers trying to do the work, and but from at a commercial level, there was incredible commercial and political pressure to launch at that, on that date. Mm-hmm. And so the message that was trying to, the engineers were saying this is unsafe, was trying to get, was sort of going through the ranks, but not, but either just not getting through, hitting brick walls or glass ceilings, through where people didn't feel safe to report that message back up, reporting concerns, or it got diluted. We sort of see this as a greenwashing effect sometimes in projects and stuff in organizations, don't we? Where, you know, red turns into an amber turns into a green, a project that's all red on the ground gets to the board level, gets to the senior execs, and it's all green on the outside. We also call it the watermelon effect sometimes, don't we? Yep. So, and we see that effect. And this is what, again, part of what caused the Challenger disaster. You could say the root cause was brittle rubber O-rings. You could say the root cause was people not passing on the message directly and a lack of psychological safety. In reality, it's more complex. Yeah,
an interesting thing I find with all of that, I was listening to I quite like the Joe Rogan podcast. We kind of style our podcast very much on Joe Rogan, except we don't have the money, an exclusive deal with Spotify or a producer that could just Google shit for us. So I have to Google it myself on my phone whilst I'm talking. But it's quite a recent episode with it. And it was really fascinating. If this automatically plays whilst I'm looking for the episode, I apologize. I just want to get the name of the guy. And it was a fascinating discussion because this guy kind of comes at everything. Peter Zeihan, I think I've pronounced that right. So Peter Zeihan, it's episode 1921. Now, this guy's got a geography background. And something else background, like academia, and essentially he's like predicts shit and is like really good at predicting shit and just puts stuff together. And anyway, it's not really relevant to what we're talking about, and there's a reason I'm going to pull it out, but just anyone listening, just go and listen to it. It's fascinating. You want to understand more about, you know, what's going on right now in Russia, with Ukraine, with China, with America, and the economy, food shortages, all of this stuff. It's fascinating to listen to. But interestingly, he touches on, he pretty much doesn't say psychological safety, but he does give examples of like, the Chinese government, I can't remember the name of the leader of the Chinese China at the moment, but like actively removing cognitive diversity from the room, actively destructively taking out psychological safety in a way. And he basically just outright says China will disappear. What we know China as will disappear on the basis that because this leader is no longer listening to what some people might call fresh eyes, different opinions and things like that, it will destroy the country. Yeah. And that's essentially what we're talking about. But what he also says, pretty much all the way through this, is we've seen it in history. He says, we've seen it through history. Mm-hmm. We've seen it through history. If your country is here, you'll do well. If your country's here, you'll do well, whatever. We've seen it in history. And I was sitting there listening to him and I was thinking, we're all like trying to work out what the one answer to like good, like risk management resilience is like. And I'm just like, we've seen it in history, man. Like it's everywhere. Like history just tells the future, doesn't it? Challenger, yeah. Boeing 737, like, was it the Max? Was it 737 Max?
737 Max, yeah.
There's that, like you've got Chernobyl, you've got, just it fucking, the list just goes on. Three Mile Island, it's just same shit over and over again.
One of the most interesting examples I came across recently, I think it was last year actually, was the Swedish warship, the Vasa. Brilliant, absolutely brilliant. In fact, there's a museum in Sweden, in Stockholm, to the Vasa, and the Vasa is a warship that is in there and you can go and see it. And it sank just outside Stockholm on its maiden voyage in 1628. And it's a fantastic example of a lack of psychological safety, because the king at the time, I can't remember the name of the king, who sort of decreed that this huge warship be built, but he decreed that this huge warship be built, and he contracted a bunch of people to do it, and he kept adding more and more specs and requirements to it, like bigger cannons, more cannons, you need more, I don't know, just kept adding stuff to it and changing the design as it was being built, and the people who were building it were aware that it was flawed, like it was going to sink, it was not a safe design, because of the way you can't design a ship and then just you know keep modifying it all the way through. And in fact, it was like lopsided and all sorts of other stuff as well. And it sank on its maiden voyage, and you know, a bunch of people died. And then because of the sea there is incredibly, incredibly cold, it was preserved really almost perfectly for like 350, 400 years almost. And they brought it back to the surface 20 or so years ago. And you can go and have a look at it. And yeah, so it's like a 400-year-old example of a lack of psychological safety causing a disaster. And you can go and have a look at it.
Wow, that's amazing. If you were gonna, I know we're trying to get you to pick a couple before, I know I'm gonna put you back in that spot. You like the majority of the listeners to Rebound and Safety, like quite mature in the mindset of like safety, risk, resilience, and all. So might I'd be surprised if they haven't heard of this concept. If you were to try and pick, say, one or two kind of disasters to say, if you haven't learned about that one, that would be your go-to kind of example to learn about. Which ones would you pick?
Oh, that's a question. I think one that immediately springs to mind, which is a really evocative one, is the Amagasaki train crash in Japan.
Well, okay.
Are you familiar with that?
I've heard the name Amagasaki rings a bell, but other than that.
So this was the high speed train in Japan that came off its rails and went into an apartment building, because it was like high up, it was one of these high up trains, whatever you call those, the train company had a very very strict, very high performance culture. But also a culture of punishment, a culture of retribution, a culture of embarrassment, a culture of humiliation if you didn't hit your targets, and had very, very tight targets to achieve. And so I'll cut the story short, but basically this train driver had already missed some targets in the past, and he'd already been bullied and humiliated for not hitting those targets of sort of the train has to get into the station at this second and leave at this second. And they'd punished and humiliated him by making him clean toilets and all sorts of like quite nasty stuff. And on this day, something had delayed the train, and he knew that he was behind schedule. And because the punishment for getting behind schedule was, and it got worse every time, so he knew it was going to be awful for him if he didn't meet his target. And he just went too fast around a bend, and the train just left the tracks and went straight into the apartment building. It was a terrible disaster, it's a horrible disaster. But it's a very visceral, real example of how an effort to try to sort of strive for these very high performance targets can actually result in disaster, because people will take whatever shortcut necessary to hit that target. That driver wasn't a bad train driver. He wasn't a bad person. And you could argue that he was to blame, but again, you know, getting back into blame, like who's to blame for that? You could argue the train driver's to blame, or his manager's to blame. Maybe his managers were told or incentivized to carry out that sort of humiliative behavior as a result of them being told by someone else, you know, where does the chain stop? So I think it's a really interesting example.
That ultimately is a really difficult challenge and an interesting challenge. And where does the chain stop? So I don't know if you've read Outliers by Malcolm Gladwell. This is a fascinating section in there, which I I can vividly remember listening to as I was driving down south, and they were talking about I can't remember what he called it, but it was like an index of countries in how hierarchical they are.
Yeah, power distance.
Yes. And like even the way they talk to each other is like based on, like they go out for dinner and the people in positions that are societally accepted as high value or whatever, talk first, eat first, whatever. So if you're in that culture, so let's say a cleaner would be classed as quite low down the chain, you're not allowed to talk, which is just in the Western world, just sounds like in Britain anyway, just sounds fucking nuts. But interestingly, like, when you say that example, when you go through that example, to me that sounds very typical of a kind of Asian, Japanese, kind of Chinese kind of culture of like failure results in embarrassment. I'm quite a big martial arts geek / fan, and that was always how martial arts was taught for years. Like if you can't do a technique, you get whacked until you do it. And a lot of martial arts stems from like Asian culture. So how far do you go? Because if that manager or that business owner has just built his style of management based off what that culture of that country is, so everybody's managing like that, how far do you go?
Well, yeah, and I think this is really fascinating because, there's a lot you can... in fact, there are some plane crashes that Malcolm Gladwell talks about that have been attributed to that sort of culture, like the Indonesian Airlines.
Yeah,
when they were speaking to air traffic control, there was an Air France flight, which had the same sort of dynamics at play. People not speaking up, and this is where the we now have the sort of phrase or the approach of CRM, cockpit resource management, or crew resource management.
Yep,
this idea, which is designed to address those sort of cultural challenges. Now, of course, you're always sort of straining against the embedded culture of the region or the community, and there'll always be these tensions. There'll always be lessons we have to unlearn, sort of cultural and sociological and societal lessons we have to unlearn. What I find really interesting, back to Taichi Ono and the Toyota production system. Now, Taichi Ono, Japanese car manufacturing, after the war, the Japanese economy was devastated, the country was devastated, the factories were devastated. They had very, very little in terms of infrastructure and they had very few people. So they had to do a lot with very little. And that was sort of part one of Taichi Ono's approach. We've got to achieve a great thing with very few resources. The second thing was I understand, crucially aware of Japanese hierarchical culture and the sort of obedience kind of culture, compliance sort of culture. And I kind of feel like that's why he's designed a system, things like the Andon Cord, that address this head on. So when someone pulls the Andon Cord in the Toyota production factory, they are praised, they are thanked for doing so, because that's an explicit mechanism by which we sort of by which we combat, we're addressing, we're trying to mitigate this impact of this sort of compliance culture, this hierarchical culture, and it was only, maybe it's only by that being so clear and present that Taichi Ono was able to recognize, oh, this, if we don't address that, it will be a problem. And maybe that's where that has come from.
Yeah. There is part of me that kind of feels sorry for a modern day business in that there's just so much now. There's so much information, isn't there? Like, and I can kind of understand with some businesses being like, I'm not being funny. Like, how did all these businesses get really quite successful and they didn't even know about all of this stuff. They just slapped people about a little bit when they did something I didn't want them to do. And I enjoy this stuff. I just recorded a podcast actually saying how like last year I just stopped listening to podcasts, stopped reading stuff, stopped following academia. I even stopped really going on LinkedIn. I'm still struggling with LinkedIn a bit now, if I'm honest, but like it's a bit exhausting, isn't it? Trying to keep up with everything that's going on.
It is. It really is. It really is exhausting. And I think there is a real challenge in sorting the signal from the noise.
Yeah.
And there is a lot more noise than there used to be. There's a lot more people generating content. There's a lot more, there's inevitably there's more and more content than there ever was. Every day there's more content than there was yesterday. So, we do have to sort through it. And this is why I think it's really powerful to kind of come back to the point we were talking about at the start, to come back to first principles, come back to the foundations, come back to the basics. And if we recognize the need to consider people as part of a system, to recognize the power in considering and treating people as real, full human beings who should feel they can be themselves at work and not feel under threat or under pressure or at risk of being humiliated or punished. For two reasons, partly because we know that that way leads to better organizational performance. We know it leads to better outcomes. We know it leads to safer outcomes as well as increased innovation. And that's what we're trying to achieve.
Yeah.
But also, maybe more importantly, is because it's the right thing to do. Mm. Like, it's the right moral, ethical, just thing to do to enable, because we spend maybe most of our lives at work. And if we don't feel safe to be ourselves, if we don't feel safe to not put a mask on at work and not sort of pretend to be someone else or sort of change ourselves, then we're doing everyone a disservice. So the right thing to do is to create foster a culture, an environment of psychological safety, partly because it's the right moral, just thing to do, but also, luckily, it results in better organizational outcomes.
Yeah. I just find it fascinating. I like to, like, that's a really nice pod clip you've just said there, so we're going to cut that up and share the shit out of that. That was lovely. That sounds like it's straight out of your keynote. I find it fascinating actually, like to have psychological safety for me is like this balance of being able to not have this fear of embarrassment and so on. But I think also what you have to be very comfortable with is the fact that to bring yourself, you have to accept that some people might not like yourself.
Yeah. Yep.
So if I was to come back to the how I know you, me and Gemma are in a networking group, right? And in this networking group, there are loads of mini groups within this big organization. Mm. And our group is very, let's say, banterful, to use a common phrase. Like, we like to have a laugh and so on. There's a trade-off to that. In our group, we tend to convert a lot of our visitors, but ultimately, there are some people that don't like it. Yeah. And we kind of have to accept that, and what that means, if I go to the group that is less banterful, I have to accept that they might not like me and I might not like that group. So that's not really for me. And I find that fascinating in organizations now, we're stuck in a place where like we feel we have to be a business for everyone. And therefore we're kind of a business for no one, or a culture for no one in a way. What are your thoughts on that?
So I think that's a really interesting point. It's a quite challenging point as well, because we sort of touched on this a little bit earlier with the idea of more homogenous groups and things. And there's a few points here, and we're getting into diversity and inclusion, which is intrinsically related to psychological safety. We should definitely address that, because, as you just alluded to, so it's easier to create psychological safety in a group that is very similar. So in a very homogenous group, if we put together a group of white, English-speaking, middle-aged men from London, Like they're probably
sounds like a fucking horrible group.
But they're all going to get on, right? They're all going to get on. They get each other. They understand each other. They understand each other's context. And the more we make that group alike, like if we select it even closer, so they're all from private schools, they're all from a particular part of the country, all these different, and then they're all gonna they're going to feel very psychologically safe because they can predict. Psychological safety is so much about predictability, predicting how the group will react to your behavior. And so if you've got a very, very similar, very predictable group, quite easy to feel psychologically safe. If you've got a very diverse group, with people with different languages, different socioeconomic backgrounds, different contexts, different life experiences, different abilities, different neurodiversities, and everything else in between, then that's creating psychological safety in that group is going to be somewhat more challenging. Yeah. However, and this is the crucial point, however, that group, the more diverse group, will ultimately be higher performing, will have better outcomes than the more homogenous group, because we'll have more diverse ideas, perspectives, better ways of challenging ideas that maybe aren't, better ways of perfecting ideas.
With a lack of cognitive diversity, psychological safety is easier. An increased amount of cognitive diversity, psychological safety is harder. But without cognitive diversity, psychological safety feels kind of pointless in a way, and because we're completely missing a whole different perspective on something.
Exactly. And in fact, there's a lot of research that shows that if you combine both cognitive diversity and and socioeconomic and other kinds of diversity as well, if you combine that diversity with psychological safety, it's like a multiplier effect. We get a team that are incredibly high performing. Diversity on its own and psychological safety on its own will not get you to that same point. But it is much harder to do. And we should strive to be more inclusive all the time. Partly again because it's the right thing to do, but partly also because we don't always know the aspects, the sort of intersectionalities and privileges and diversities that are within the group. We might not know that someone in the group is trans, or someone in the group is an orphan, or someone else in the group is a refugee. We might not know these things. So we should strive to be as inclusive as possible, to make sure everyone feels included, because it's not always explicit. So
it's uncomfortable, isn't it? Like, but it's a good uncomfortable. I remember we had Dr. Dara Blumenthal on the podcast. God, it feels like years ago now, because she did a lovely kind of hand-drawn kind of flow chart of if you want psychological safety, you need this, and if you want this, you need this, and it kind of showed the depth of actually how much it required there. But I think we even got it in the intro of Rebrand and Safety, or the kind of generic intro we use, in that she said in the podcast, I don't think I'll ever forget, was it's about feeling comfortable to be uncomfortable.
Exactly that. It's about feeling comfortable to be uncomfortable, and it's about working to create an environment where other people feel comfortable in challenging you, or questioning you, or suggesting ideas to you, or giving you. Imagine someone in the group needs to give you bad news, or give you news that you don't want to hear. Have you created the environment in which they feel perfectly comfortable to tell you that? And if you can't confidently answer yes, well, in fact, even if you can confidently answer yes, you might be wrong. But that's what you're trying to get to. One of the ways of doing that, we can get into this in another episode, but because maybe we can talk about sort of all the ways to do it. But one of the ways to do it, I think I heard Amy Edmondson say quite a while ago, was one of the best ways to create psychological safety is to pretend it already exists.
Nice, I like that.
Act as if it already exists, particularly if you're in a leadership position or position of privilege, say maybe you've been with the company decades, or much longer than everyone else on the team, so you're in a sort of position of privilege through tenure or something else. If you've got that sort of privilege to act like it already exists, begins to create a safer space for everyone else to foster those same behaviors.
Yeah, I like that. We definitely need to get into on one of the episodes. It's like, what does this look like? How do you do this kind of stuff? Because I think that is where some people really struggle. But the what you kind of quote, you quoted Amy there, and I find that really interesting. Sounds very similar to, like, I think it was Gandhi that said, "Be the change that you want to see."
Yeah.
Very similar. Like, yeah. And I often say to, like, businesses that we work with, like, look, someone's got to go first. There's always someone who's got to go
first. Yeah.
Always. And in an organization, the person with the power and the security is the top of the organization. You have the power. You have all of the safety in a way. Like, you're the, no one's really going to challenge you, especially if you don't have psychological safety within your organization. So you kind of have to go first. And if you go first, then everyone else will come with you. And I find in safety, we all even worked with organizations that have said, like, why would I invest in people's safety when they're not even wearing their PPE? And I'm like, mate, because it's not as simple as that, unfortunately. Someone's got to go first. And if you want to do, I think if you want to do it, at least have a quicker impact. If the top goes first, it's always going to be more powerful, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. And in fact, not wearing PPE is really, really, really sort of, really almost obvious example of where we're missing a trick with psychological safety. And we so often see work sites, construction sites, and other places where people aren't wearing PPE, for example. And I almost guarantee that if you see, like, a bunch of people, and some of them, you know, and a load of people aren't wearing their helmets, aren't wearing goggles, whatever, some of them, maybe all of them, are probably thinking, do you know what, I want to put my hard hat on, I want to put my goggles on, I want to put my gloves on, I want to put my high vis on, but I'm conscious that someone on the group is going to say something if I do.
Yeah. Which, well, this is fascinating, because I definitely want to get this in our notes to talk about, but where does banter sit, and what, how does that impact psychological safety? Because that's kind of what we're touching on here.
Yeah.
And I think that's fascinating. Like, I want to put my hard hat on because I don't want to die, but no one else is. No.
Yeah.
And I'm a safety professional. Even I suffer from that sometimes. Like, I walk past a sign, says mandatory hearing protection. I know I should do it. No one else is doing it. And I'm like, there's like this battle in my head.
Yeah.
Like, this social two sides of me that are like, I want to conform to the crowd.
Yeah.
But then I also need to lead by example because I'm the safety guy. And then I also am very aware of the fact that somebody's put that sign there for a reason, and I don't want to be more deaf than I already am.
Exactly. And I love that you've just talked about conformity as well, because I remember, I was at school, and I think we did a little lesson, and I wouldn't actually suggest that teacher, I'm not sure this is a great approach to, but it stuck with me, where some kid was sent out of the classroom for 5 minutes or something, and the rest of the class, we all agreed to that this is what we would do. And the teacher said, when Bob comes back in, we're going to ask Bob what 5 times 5 is. But we're going to insist that 5 times 5 is 20. And he's going to comply, and he's going to conform. And so we, you know, Bob comes back in, we start doing our times tables, and everyone says 5 times 5 is 20. And Bob's like, And then we ask Bob, what's 5 times 5? And Bob says, 20. Knowing it's wrong. It's definitively wrong. But the need to comply, the need to conform is so strong in the group that we'll do something that will do and state something that is completely known to be wrong just to conform with the group.
Yeah.
And that's so powerful. And yeah, it comes back to safety and PPE and everything that we're talking about with psychological safety.
Yeah. I could talk about this all day, but both of us have got real jobs to do. But like, I always find, I don't know why, I might be a bit geeky with this stuff. I love watching films and TV shows and stuff. So I tend to like gravitate towards visual and audible kind of content a lot more. I struggle to sit down and read a paper and stuff. That's hard work for me. So I tend to do it. But I do find a lot of like, I find like films, even fictional films, fictional drama and stuff like that, it's kind of like, I don't know if you've ever heard the phrase, I can't remember who who said it, but they quote it in Thor in the Avengers as well, where like science fiction is just a precursor to science.
Yeah.
So like, it's someone making up some random bullshit about lightsabers or whatever. It just it prompts somebody to think, I could make that. And then eventually it just becomes science, right?
Yeah.
And I find that normal films, you were to watch, Game of Thrones, for example, it's an exaggeration of real life. So if you imagine the Lannister family as an organization and the Stark family as an organization, you can start to see pros and cons of what you would want to see. It's just an exaggeration of normal life. Yeah. And I always find like, if people can make this up and put it in a book and in a film, like it's come from somewhere and it's in your organization probably.
Yeah, completely. And we see those sorts of dynamics in organizations, you know, and we see the sort of, And I think back to, I think you mentioned something a while back about sort of the sort of instinctively we can run teams and organizations in the old way, you know, the Taylorist sort of punishment for mistakes and sort of crack the whip and do as you're told kind of way. And we will get short term results. We will get short term good outcomes, but they'll be short term. The problem is actually a lot of the time that we're only looking at the short term.
Yeah, yeah.
We only ever measure the short term.
Yeah, yeah.
Companies, teams might only exist for 6 months, a year, 2 years. And we look at that and go, well, that was a success. How did they do that? Oh, well, they whipped everyone who made a mistake. Well, then we should probably do that over here. But for long-term outcomes, and as humans, we're not as good at thinking in long-term outcomes. We're not as good at thinking in complex socio-technical systems. We always want to come back to the simplistic in the short term, and that's where we begin to fall down.
I think Daniel Pink covers that quite well in his work, and his book is quite an easy read for I can't remember what that's called.
We talked about motivation, but yes, I can't remember what the book is called.
It's got a simple like one word anyway.
Drive.
Yeah, that's a easy read for anyone, you know, even if you're if you're not really like, well, I'm not going to read Deming and all of this stuff. Like, Drive is such a simple, easy read, and it's full of like real good snippets of like scientific research where they show you that, you know, carrot and stick doesn't work. You got to set that base level. Obviously, we need to pay people. I find talking about misinterpretations of like what people are saying. We've kind of touched on that in Amy's work, but like the amount of people that I said, oh yeah, I've read Daniel's work. I really like that. I'm just not paying anyone and just making sure they find flow. And I'm like, no, that's not what he says. What he says is you just set a base level of a fair salary and then find flow.
Well, and even that idea isn't new. Like Deming was suggesting the same thing decades ago and saying that we should get rid of incentive programs, we should get rid of bonuses, because once we provide people with a comfortable living, so that they don't need to, so when they're at work, they're not worrying about money, you know, they're able to live a comfortable life and have leisure time and everything else, then the vast majority of people actually just want to get meaning and satisfaction from their work. And actually, the provision of incentives and metrics and bonuses distort work. And in fact, a lot of the time can damage work and damage outcomes because we find we're incentivizing the thing that we actually didn't want to incentivize, or we find there's some inadvertent and unintended consequence of incentivizing this thing over this thing.
Well, mate, I think we've gone all over the shop on a messy introduction into psychological data, but I think we covered quite a lot there and kind of some important names, some good examples of kind of disasters. I think starting off with a good definition, I think it was really important, but I think we'll get into over the next two episodes, maybe a bit more chunk. And then also a bit more of like what this actually looks like in reality and how it works. But before we get to there, mate, like, let us know about your company, what you do, and if people are like, I need some help with this stuff and they want to talk to you more, how can they do that?
Brilliant. Thanks. Well, thanks for having me on. I'm really enjoying this. It's fantastic. If anyone wants to get in touch, head over to psychsafety.com and there's a whole bunch of resources there. So there's a bunch of free resources. So if you just want to like learn more about it, download some templates, some workshop ideas, some just learn more, there's a whole bunch of free stuff on there. There's also a downloadable toolkit. There's a community, an online community that you can join to share and learn from other folks in the field. There's a weekly newsletter that I fire out, so you can sign up to that. And what else we've got? We've got regular meetups, and you can sign up to training courses, open enrollment workshops, and stuff like that. You can also just get in touch with me to find out if there's, well, if you're interested in me working or us working with your organization, your teams, and doing some other like long-term program, transformation program kind of work with the organization. But yeah, head over to psychsafety.com and it's all there.
Yeah, there's loads of value on your website, mate, and loads of stuff for free, which is really nice of you to do that. And it's gold dust. I've had a look at some stuff. I didn't know you had the community, so I'll check that out as well. But if you send us the links and everything or whatever you want to mention, we'll put that in the notes below so that everyone can go and find that. But in the meantime, thank you very much for episode one, Tom. It was a pleasure having you on.
Thank you so much. It's a real honor to be on. I really enjoyed it. Thank you so much.
Okay, peeps, hope you enjoyed that episode. If you want to learn more about Tom or you want to check out his business, all the links that he mentioned are in the description below. If you need some help with this stuff, obviously you can go to Tom. If you need it from a more safety, kind of human safety performance side of things, then 100% come and check us out as well, riskfluentltd.com. Drop me an email if you're not sure, and we'll be honest. If you think it's better to go to Tom, then we'll let you know. We're not going to do something we can't do because it's not good for us. But drop me an email, james@riskfluentltd.com, and hopefully we'll talk soon. Make sure you follow us on stuff as well, LinkedIn, and we're not very good on Facebook and the other stuff, so probably just LinkedIn. Catch you next week. Safe.
The views and opinions expressed in this podcast are those of the host and its guests and do not necessarily reflect the position of the companies. Examples of analysis discussed within this podcast are examples only based on limited and dated open source information and should not be utilised in real life as the only solution available. Assumptions made within this analysis are not reflective of the position of the companies. No part of this podcast may be reproduced, stored, or transmitted in any form or by any means, mechanical, electronic, or otherwise, without prior written permission from James McPherson.